Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good morning. This is Doug Field, the CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism and your host of today's show. And welcome to this week's edition of Healthcare Consumerism Radio. And I'm joined in studio by our radio producer, Jonathan Field. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice rainy day here in Georgia today. Everyone's back to school down here in the South, already back to school. So things are kind of resuming a sense of normalcy down here in regular schedules. We've got a great program today. We're going to open up here in about 10 minutes with Robert Gilbert, the president of Fair Health, a leading nonprofit transparency organization. And Robert's going to specifically be talking about kind of the recent spat of activity involving consumer protection laws around the surprise bills around emergency services that consumers are facing. And then following Robin will be Kevin Robertson, Senior VP, Director of Sales with HSA Bank. And Kevin's going to be talking about the latest DOL regulations and fiduciary standards and their impact on HSA. They just completed actually a white paper on that. So that'll be kind of the heart of the interview. So pretty good discussion today with, two friends of the Institute. And we look forward to having them both on the program. And Robin, by the way, is going to be speaking at Private Exchange Forum coming up in Baltimore on September 8th through 9th. And Jonathan, we're kind of hard at work there, aren't we, on getting everything nailed down for that program?
Yeah, that's right. We are about 5 weeks now, actually slightly less than 5 weeks until the first day of that conference. So, you know, this is about the time when everything starts coming together.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, everyone's been talking recently about a current liaison survey and, you know, I like kind of a title. I think, Jonathan, you might even posted this liaison on our website, but it says, the opportunity exists in educating HR professionals about the benefits of private exchanges. And that's kind of the heart and soul of what we're all about with Private Exchange Forum and our exchange content. And there's just a tremendous amount of confusion in the marketplace. And our goal is really to bring this market together, to bring all stakeholders, employers, which are the benefit leaders, the HR executives within employers, their advisors, consultants, the TPAs and health plans, certainly all the exchange players and the product solutions that look to be part of exchanges, into the same environment. And, you know, around our content, which we'll talk about in a minute through our general sessions and workshops, really engage that discussion so people can really understand, you know, what is happening? What is an exchange? What isn't an exchange? You know, what are the needs of your workforce? Can this help you lower costs? Can it help you lower administrative resources or use administrative resources more wisely? And how can it offer benefit choice, better benefit choice to your employees? Right, Jonathan? I mean, that's our goal, really, is to bring this market together to collaborate.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we have a number of great speakers lined up. Our usual mix of multi-stakeholder perspectives. So if you come to the event, you'll be able to hear from, you know, fellow employers, you know, your HR benefits peers. You know, we have the kind of more high-level consultants like Ryan Howells at Levitt Partners, who, you know, is leads an industry organization on private exchanges and is going to provide the keynote.
Yep.
You know, to Paul Fronston, you know, well-known economist in this industry. Of course, you know, John Young, Mike Smith. These are regular people that speak at many of our events. And so it's a good mix of speakers we have coming together.
It's a good mix of titles. You know, we always open up our event with that multi-stakeholder perspective, you know, which really a title our private exchanges meeting expectations. What are they doing? What aren't they doing? You know, where are they misunderstood? You know, we follow really talking about what has ultimately got to be, you know, an important part, and that's the consumer experience. You know, how is this empowering consumers to select the right benefits? And we've added a very, I think, a very topical general session should be a lively discussion on entitled "The Time Is Now, The Tools Are Here, HR Benefits and Exchange Technology That Delivers." And we're finalizing some of those spots. It's going to be highlighted and led by our conference co-chair, John Young. So that should be an interesting discussion around this whole technology evolution that's taking place around benefit delivery, benefit enrollment, benefit accessibility. Then we'll certainly have our employer panel where we bring in together leading employers. Rapid Fire, which we'll repeat at Forum West later this year, which has been received very well at our conferences this year, which is will be 10 to 13 different innovators giving 3 to 5 minute elevator pitches, you know, to our entire audience. You know, should be well received. Then our health plan panel, leading health plans, really talking about what they're doing inside exchanges, what they're doing with their own proprietary exchanges. And then you alluded to Mike Smith heading up kind of the friendly food on what are brokers doing or not doing, you know, around utilizing technology, benefit technology, and exchanges. So, you know, pretty dynamic general session track. Anything you want to add on the general session, Jonathan?
Well, yeah, you actually, we're excited to have Ryan Howells as our keynote speaker. So, you know, on the morning of the first day of the conference, you know, he's going to be delivering a 15 to 20 minute keynote that will start everything off. And I think that it's going to open a lot of eyes to kind of where this technology might be headed over the next 2-3 years. For those of you that don't know, Ryan is a principal Levitt Partners. He's based out of Chicago office. And he was recently, I believe maybe late last year, named executive director of the Private Exchange Coalition. So he has that inside experience from working with all of these various exchange providers. And his keynote actually is Private Exchanges as a Vehicle for Delivery System Reform. So he is going to be talking about these recent moves from CMS to shift you know, healthcare payment to a more value-based system, and how he believes private exchanges will play a large role in that.
Yeah, we're pretty excited to have Ryan do this and kick it off, and then Ryan will become so we're excited to have that, and then follow with the leading stakeholders, really, talking about that topic and other elements that are happening. And certainly we have our workshop tracks, too. We have two key workshop tracks, you know, running through this event. We'll talk about health management and the integral part of health management to a well-executed private exchange benefit model. We'll have a session on non-health voluntary benefits for leading players, talking about that. Defined contribution healthcare, hand-on workshop led by John Young. A very interesting health plan decision support shootout led by Mike Levin with Veracree and four other leading players, really talking about where decision support is evolving and how critical it is to help individuals make better health plan decisions and choices. Employer case study track. Right now we've got Sarah Craig, who's the Director of Human Resources of MedFlight, as one of our case studies. Then certainly talking about, you know, going beyond enrollment, going beyond those initial benefit plan choices to talk about telehealth and its part of the model, talk about transparency,
right,
other solutions that are emerging. The second track will talk about retiree healthcare costs and supplemental health. So
yeah, just a reminder to everyone listening out there, we do currently have early bird rates for this event. That is through midnight Eastern on Tuesday. So end of the day Tuesday, make sure you register for the event because they will go up to our standard rates starting Wednesday morning.
Yeah. And so, again, we hope to see you in Baltimore on September 8th and 9th. And now I'd like to welcome in our first guest, who is also going to be one of our speakers in Baltimore, Robin Gilbred, with President of Fair Health. Robin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to speak to you and your audience.
Yeah, and look forward to seeing you in about 5 weeks in Baltimore as well.
Absolutely.
Hey, I know we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, this activity around, you know, consumer protection laws and surprise bills and emergency services, but for our audience that may not have heard you before, give our audience a little background around Fair Health, if you would, please.
Sure. Fair Health is a very unique organization. It was created out of a settlement back in 2009 from an investigation brought by then Attorney General Cuomo into the insurance industry. They were looking at the way in which out-of-network services were being reimbursed, and they found that there were pervasive conflicts of interest in the marketplace that really needed to be solved. So the matter never went to trial. All of the parties agreed that a new paradigm should be created. And toward that end, they established a new independent not-for-profit, that's Fair Health. We're tasked with housing a private healthcare claims collection that can inform decision-making for all stakeholders around the country, for maintaining a free website to give consumers access to medical and dental information, and for making available a platform for policymaking and research to really help folks ask and answer the hard questions that are plaguing the healthcare system today.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it, and I think you guys are doing some great work. I love this topic we're going to talk about today because personally, Robin, I had an experience early this year where I had my dear wife and my grandson at Disney World, and we had an emergency situation with my wife. So I did get surprised by some of these emergency care at facilities outside of my network. And you just got to take care of the situation then. It was totally out of my hands and did not realize that was going to hit me. And so let's talk a bit about it, about the surprise balance bills, the surprise, you know, that we consumers get, you know, around our medical costs and what is being done.
Sure. Well, you are certainly not alone. There are two areas where there has recently been a lot of legislative attention. One is the situation that you just mentioned where someone needs emergency care, and by the fact that it is emergency, they can't really deliberate and pick an in-network facility and make choices about where they're going to go. You may even be on vacation, as you were, even away from your area of residence. And in that instance, when there is a true emergency, what people have been learning is that after the care is rendered, people have been receiving rather substantial bills for those emergency services, often treated as out-of-network bills. So that's one area of inequity that has been addressed by the legislature, where they're trying to hold consumers harmless to what would be the in-network rate of services for that emergency care. The other scenario that is quite pervasive all across the country is the situation where you receive out-of-network services, oftentimes at an in-network facility. That happened to me, for example, when I had my baby at an in-network facility, knowing it was in my plan's provider network, and then at the end of the day receiving a bill for an epidural by an anesthesiologist who was out of network. Again, a situation that consumers are not typically aware of, and so in the wake of doing their homework for that in-network facility, they can again receive sizable bills from providers who are not part of their plan's network. So those are really the two main areas that have received a lot of attention from policymakers and legislators around the country. Some states have actually already passed legislation to address some of these issues, and some are debating it as we speak to think of the right solution for their particular jurisdiction.
Now, has New York passed something? Is there a New York statute right now? Or?
There is a New York law, and actually New York really came out of the gate in a way that attracted a lot of attention. It was considered actually quite groundbreaking in its reach. Actually, the New York Times, in the wake of the passage of the bill, said it is a law that other states should look to and gain inspiration from because of the breadth of protection afforded to consumers. It was passed in 2014 but became effective March 31st of 2015. So we just passed basically the one-year anniversary of it. And what it did was really interesting. First of all of the key stakeholders were around the table as it was being deliberated. You had the hospitals, you had providers, consumer advocates, and a number of other key stakeholder groups, everyone recognizing that these issues needed to be addressed. And what they determined to do was, one, they created a term and codified it in the statute, the term usual and customary cost. And they defined it very carefully as the 80th percentile of an independent database unaffiliated with any insurer. And what they did with this term was they basically used it as a backdrop to help inform the conversations and the negotiations amongst the plan and the provider. They said if a consumer is confronted with an emergency situation or a surprise bill for out-of-network services that they did not anticipate, the consumer will be held harmless to the in-network amount that their plan would otherwise charge, and it's up to the plan and the provider to sort out what would be a fair level of reimbursement. They did not require that the level of reimbursement be at that 80th percentile UCC, but it, in a sense, informed the conversation between the two parties. If those two parties could not agree, the statute provided for a very detailed dispute resolution process that indicated that that dispute resolution entity could look at UCC, what that 80th percentile was in that particular community, to help resolve the dispute. Significantly, the Department of Financial Services, which is our Department of Insurance in New York, designated Fair Health as the only data source that met that definition of independence and lacking any affiliation with the insurance community. So, in effect, our 80th percentile is helping to inform these conversations between the provider and the plan. And our understanding is, as we pass that year anniversary, there seems to be general agreement that the bill is working. It is encouraging and leading to resolution between the provider and the plan. And the consumers, as you see, they have a blanket of protection for them being held only to the in-network amount.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, has Connecticut done something similar, the way I understand it, or where are they?
Well, it's interesting. So the country is sort of acting as, I guess, the founding fathers intended, in the sense that it was always assumed that states would be their own laboratories. It was always encouraged that states should create legislation that meets the particular needs of their state. Connecticut chose to go in a slightly different direction. Their focus was on emergency services particularly. And what they did was they did not have a backdrop sort of encouraging the conversation between the plan and the provider. They actually prescribed what the resolution should be, and the insurance department of the state of Connecticut issued, you know, a formal guidance memoranda that indicated that the healthcare provider would be paid the greatest of three amounts, either the in-network amount that that plan would typically pay for that service, a UCR rate, usual and customary and reasonable rate for such services, or the amount Medicare would pay. So that's basically, those three categories are in the statute, and then what the commissioner did was put a gloss on what UCR means, and they said, again, it would be Fair Health, 80th percentile shall constitute UCR for purposes of the Connecticut bill. So again, you know, sort of a slightly different approach, but trying to tackle some of the same inequities that, you know, patients all over the country are experiencing with respect to emergency care.
So Robin, you have a unique bird's eye view of the whole country too, Ed, from your seat. So what else is happening across the country out when you get outside of Connecticut and New York, which are very interesting initiatives? What else is happening or being considered?
Well, something that we're noticing, because we are privileged to be the custodians of the largest private healthcare claims collection in the country, essentially 20 billion records for over 150 million people. So in some ways, we're like the canary in the coal mine, because we can see things that are happening sometimes before they get into full view. And although a lot of folks are talking about this, we're seeing it very crisply, is the changing dynamics in where people are accessing care or how they are accessing care. So, for example, we're seeing, you know, material changes in the number of procedures being done at urgent care centers and at ambulatory surgery centers, and the number of people who are going to retail clinics for care. And it's interesting about retail clinics, because of the de-identified claims that we see, in the past, it used to be primarily for vaccines. I know I would take my boys to, you know, the local drugstore, to their inside clinic for a flu shot. But the claims now are showing people are having full primary care visits at the retail clinics, which is a changing dynamic. And we are also seeing, you know, uptick in the number of claims involving telemedicine, which is really fascinating as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many different changing venues for care, and that in turn will likely bleed into changes in provider networks that plans will constitute, and so it's fascinating to see this unfolding in real time.
Yeah, it is, and I mean, I think it's all a part of this consumerism movement. Is if we, as we, you know, put consumers out there more in front of all these claims, we need to help them, you know, protect themselves. First of all, consumers do to take advantage of these protections, but what can their employers do to help educate, you know, their employees and their consumers about this?
No, that's an excellent question. You don't want this type of protective legislation to be like a tree in the forest that falls that nobody hears. I mean, it doesn't protect consumers unless they are aware of it. So I think employers can really be helpful to their employees by making available to them different educational resources. For example, our free consumer website, fairhealthconsumer.org, has educational materials about the New York bill, and we also have information about ways in which to avoid going to an in-network facility and receiving out-of-network care, or at least to be aware of that situation. So whether the employers direct employees to our site or other materials, clearly they would be doing, you know, or providing a major benefit by making that information easily accessible. What consumers can do once they know about the bill is make sure that they fit within those protections. So, for example, sadly, what we have learned from our consumer survey is that there's still a sizable amount of people who go to the emergency room for non-urgent care. They may not be familiar with, you know, primary care venues open to them, or for whatever reason they are going there when it is not truly an emergency. The protections in these bills, whether New York or Connecticut, will apply if it really is an emergency that you're going to the emergency room for. If you're going there for, you know, strep throat or something that could be treated in a different venue, whether it's an urgent care center or your primary care doctor's office or even a retail clinic, consumers should know that they should really step that down, that facility, and go to another area, because otherwise they will still remain exposed to those balance bills.
Yeah. What other, from your perch too, as we kind of come to the end of this program, what other trends do you see around transparency that you need to make our audience aware of, that, you know, what do you see emerging that we need to be aware of?
I think, you know, we're delighted, given that our mission is to bring transparency to health insurance information. We're really, you know, as I said, delighted that transparency is in sort of the national spotlight right now. And where we have moved is actually from transparency to clarity, because while transparency, in a sense, is the first step to make certain types of information available to consumers, you really need to move to that next level of clarity so they can really digest the information and make it actionable. And I think what you'll see in this next wave of activity is really a concerted effort to really distill the information down to ways in which consumers can use it to be better advocates for themselves. So in other words, not just providing data to them, but really seeing what it means, how it could help decision making, really providing information that's geographically relevant to them, that is independent, that's conflict-free, that's presented in user-friendly, formats, so that people can really just run with it and have it be meaningful. Again, it's the same thing like the legislation. You don't want these transparency tools to be like trees in the forest that nobody hear.
Yep. I love your transparency to clarity. I think it makes a lot of sense. Sounds like an emerging article, Robin.
There's no shortage of those at Fair Health. In fact, we are thrilled at the reception that our recent piece on opioid dependency and abuse just received all across the country. It was just released last week, and you may have seen that what we uncovered is that there was an astronomical increase in the amount of services being rendered to those with opioid abuse and dependency, showing that not only is there issues at that micro level between, you know, on the individual level, excuse me, but also at the systemic level, the healthcare system is really being really challenged with the amount of care and services to meet this growing area of concern. So there's no shortage of articles, and I'll add that to the list.
Yeah, Robin, great having you on the program, as always. Great discussion. As we kind of close this program, leave our audience with two or three takeaways, if you would, please.
Yes, I think, as I said, the audience should be aware of these burgeoning laws involving surprise out-of-network bills and emergency care, and check with their departments of insurance or health to see whether in their states there has been any movement in this area, and to make sure that they understand the particulars of that legislation so they can take advantage of those particular laws. And likewise, to really to not be intimidated by health insurance information. It can be complex. Sometimes people are very intimidated by it, but I really invite folks to come to our free website. We really put out a welcome mat for consumers so they can learn about the principles and the glossary, the language of insurance, to really allow them to be better advocates for themselves.
And again, Robin, would you share that website with our audience, please?
Absolutely. It's fairhealthconsumer.org.
Robin, thank you so much. And I want to remind my audience, too, that you can join us at Private Exchange Forum in Baltimore, where Robin will be present and speaking. And thanks again, Robin, for taking time out of your morning. Very, very great discussion. And we'll talk to you and see you real soon.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Robin. Topic transfer continues to mature itself and evolve. And I like what she's talking about mm-hmm. transparency to clarity. You know, it's one thing to give consumers access, employees and consumers access, the other to help them understand what it means, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So great discussion. And again, Robin will be with us in Baltimore, as we talked about earlier, at our Private Exchange Forum. As Jonathan alluded to on the opening segment, Early Bird ends next Tuesday, and you go to privateexchangeforum.com and register. As we're waiting for Kevin, too, we're hard at work on our next event, IHC Forum West, coming up in November, following the election, November 9th and 10th. It'll be a busy time, be a very proactive time. That event's geared to focus on innovation and practical solutions that people are looking at for next year, and will certainly evolve into a policy outlook discussion, I'm sure, you know, across the exhibit hall. And then we have Super Saver rates available right now, and you register to the event at theiaccforum.com. But also, anyone out there who has a topic that you'd like to speak on, subject matter that's relative that you want to submit to us, let us know and let us hear about it, because we're open to we're looking for speakers to fill out the program. We have some topics that open spots are still open for certain topics, and certainly any of you sponsors listening, we'd love to have you join us at IHC Forum West. Jonathan, as we wait Kevin come on here in a minute or so, you and your team are hard at work on Superstars and Innovators as well. Get nominations close next week, and the chance for anyone to nominate a good employer, client, a broker, a consultant, an innovator in this space. They'll be showcased at IHC Forum West at a formal award ceremony, and you can go there to our homepage, theiacc.com. Where you can find access to last year's awards and also the nomination form for this year. And we urge you to take that time. It's a chance to really recognize those hidden heroes out there that are getting work done within their organizations or for organizations, and certainly to showcase innovators that are doing some really innovative things with technology and other solutions in this space, because that's really what it's all about, finding the people that are doing good work and generating good programs that save money, that provide better choice, better care, and can help, you know, employers and their employees, move down the road with their benefit plans and healthcare.
Yeah, that's right. We always kind of, this time of the year when we start getting the superstar nominations, we start finding the some really good stories about, HR and benefits managers really using anything from HSAs to telehealth to private exchanges to, create a better workforce environment and to help the overall health of the business, both physical health and, of course, the financial health on the bottom line. So, we have a lot of great nominations, as you mentioned, and Monday is the final day to nominate. We extended it. We had numerous requests for that, so we did extend it. Go to DICC.com and just nominations. You'll see it right there on the homepage and nominate someone.
Yeah, great opportunity. I'd like to welcome on our next guest, Kevin Robertson. Kevin,
good morning
to you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good to have you join us, Kevin, as always. Give our audience, before we kind of jump into these DOL fiduciary standards and their impact on HSAs, give us a little background on HSA Bank for our audience, please.
Sure. So obviously HSA Bank is one of the largest HSA and notional product custodians in the United States, serving several million customers, about $5 billion in HSA assets. Early entrance into the HSA marketplace and have always been a leader in the market space. And we are domiciled in essentially in Wisconsin, although our parent corporation, which is Webster Bank, is domiciled in Connecticut. So we are part of a larger entity, but we have about 500 employees in and near the Wisconsin marketplace and then spread out all over the United States.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Kevin, help us understand the 600 pages of these new DOL regulations that came out earlier this year, and their impact on HSAs. So, what are these new and fiduciary standards? And why do they exist, and what's the impact on HSAs?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. Right now, we're really just trying to make sure everyone understands, really what the fiduciary standards are and really the fact that they do impact HSAs. I think it's caught a lot of people by surprise because it's not something that they would have maybe normally thought or been aware of what the regulations were. So why don't we start there and talk a little bit about what the guidance is. So the Department of Labor issued guidance in April, and it really was about 5 years in the making. This is something that's been on the DOL's to-do list as well as a top objective of the Obama administration. Originally, the fiduciary standards and guidelines were designed to curb what I guess I'll call were questionable practices by investment advisors, really on retirement plans, putting essentially their own, income needs ahead of their clients' best interests, and painting all sorts of bad pictures of investors, unsavory investors taking advantage of little old ladies in their retirement plans. I mean, that's really the genesis of it.
Uh-huh.
But the DOL sought to really broaden the spectrum of what the rules were and what types of plans that they impact. So the rules, all 600 pages of them, really kind of focus on a couple of core areas. Number one is either new or clarified definitions around several concepts such as fiduciary and what constitutes investment advice and recommendations. And really expands, the second component is expanding the concept of fiduciary responsibilities and for the first time requiring a much broader spectrum of entities that were not previously considered to be fiduciaries, making them fiduciaries and then ultimately saying what they have to do to comply with the guidelines. In that vein, additionally, HSAs were caught up in this because you, again, would think that HSAs are not a retirement vehicle. Well, because of the investment aspects and long-term saving aspects of HSAs and other similar products, quite honestly, the new regulations now extend to pension and 401k plans, retirement vehicles, of course, things like IRAs, but even extend now to health savings accounts, the old Archer MSAs, even Coverdell savings accounts, really any of those plans. They all have now fallen under the guise of the DOL fiduciary responsibilities.
So what is that impact? I mean, they're under the guidelines. So what does that mean to we out there, the employers offering this plan to others? What does it mean?
Sure. I mean, really it is. At first glance, you'd probably think that it's really not that big of a change. And in the grand scheme of things, this is not an issue where the sky is falling or it's going to be tremendously burdensome to the employer. But bottom line is, for the first time, employers' responsibilities, the core relationship of an employer's responsibility towards their employees for both their retirement vehicles and, in addition to that, health savings account changes. And not only do the administrators have to make sure that they're complying, to make sure that, for instance, the educational resources and communication resources that they're deploying, don't cross the line and make certain recommendations or provide investment advice, or that they're essentially acting in the best interest in a fiduciary capacity and acting in the best interest of the account holders, but also that is requiring the employers that previously could have a kind of a hands-off approach, now is saying, oh no, Mr. and Ms. Employer, you now have the responsibility of managing and making sure that your plans are compliant and the vendors that you select and utilize are also compliant in that same vein. So there are some things that an employer is going to have to do to comply, as well as there are some things that the banks and custodians are going to have to do to try and look and make sure that the way that they're impacting and the way that they're touching the customers is in full compliance with the regulations. I'll give you an example of some potential impacts that may be necessary. First of all, not only do the administrators, but also the employers that are hiring those administrators need to make sure that the fees being charged to participants within their programs are appropriate and fully disclosed. The disclosure piece is really a big thing that you're going to notice it probably more than anything else, where disclosure level is going to go up dramatically. That is for a foregone conclusion. That is absolutely going to happen. Reviewing, for instance, like I said, education and communication materials, and making sure that what they're deploying doesn't cross that line that constitute an advice or a recommendation. And under the new guidelines, a lot of the guidelines was around that concept of really trying to provide clearer definitions of really what is investment advice and what does constitute a recommendation. Potentially, there might be some changes that either an administrator or an employer might need to make to their investment offerings within their products to make sure that they're being offered and structured in the best interest of the employees and the participants. And quite honestly, there might be either new contracts or at least certain addendums that employers might need to have with vendors to make sure that they're ensuring and understand the processes involved that their vendors that they're selecting to use for whatever services, whether it be on a 401k provider or an HSA custodian, is in full compliance as well too. So there are some things that are going to have to occur here.
Yeah, is this now, Kevin? Is the timing now, or when is the timing of these new regs?
Sure. So, technically the regulations are already in effect. They became in effect 60 days essentially after when they were first brought forth in April. However, that even though everyone's already subject to the rules, there's some key dates with regard to formal compliance with the rules. The first date that you need to be mindful of is April 10th, 2017, and that's really where the conduct and disclosure requirement compliance is required. So in other words, everyone needs to be conducting themselves in the appropriate fashion, disclosing the fees and the structures and so on and so forth. All of that compliance is necessary by next April. And then January 1st, 2018 is when quote-unquote full compliance takes effect, and that's really where you need to make sure that obviously the best interest contract standards and so on and so forth, all the full compliance with everything that's in the regulations. Now, one of the things to be mindful of here is a potential for either changes or delays to the rules. These rules are, quite honestly, they impact a lot more than just HSAs. HSAs were caught in this net, but this is a wide sweeping changes that impact a lot of business and a lot of advisors. As such, it's quite a contentious issue and political football, I'll call it. So already you've seen from Congress attempts to change or kill the regulations. The president vetoed those, and I don't see that changing until the next president is elected, whoever it may be. So that may have an impact on this, as well as there have been a number of lawsuits. I think the last time I looked, 5 major lawsuits that have been filed in various federal courts that are challenging either the DOL's their ability, their jurisdiction to essentially assert this authority, or in seeking changes or delaying implementation of the rules as well too. So it's definitely something that everyone's going to be mindful of, is that there are strong efforts to in opposition to try and impact, delay, or change these regulations, and there could be some fallout for that. So it's something to keep in mind.
It's one of the biggest challenges right now, too, Kevin. I mean, it's why we're talking today, and I know you guys are doing a lot of heavy lifting around your white paper and other things, is that it's just awareness to all these moving parts and awareness to, you know, to what employers and advisors others need to be cognizant of, you know, what this all entails.
Yes, absolutely, and you have to remember that you know, this is something new. This is not like this was existing guidance that's been tweaked a little bit. There are certain concepts here, especially extending or expanding the spectrum of who is a fiduciary and what their responsibilities may entail. They've never had rules that captured employers' responsibilities in such a fashion as this. So it's going to take a little time of adjustment, and quite frankly, what we're seeing in our own business, and as well as I think what's going on in the entire HSA industry, as well as really, again, because this is something that far greater reaching than just HSAs, in the retirement and advisory capacity as well. You know, the banks and the mutual fund companies and the investment advisors, I mean, everyone is quite honestly still evaluating how to comply. You know, in the 600 pages of regulations, it says you must comply, but it doesn't tell you exactly how to comply, right? So, you know, I know that, for instance, we just about every other major bank in the United States and financial entities have, you know, engaged outside counsels that are, you know, specifically experts in ERISA and DOL regulation as well, to try and make sure that we are in compliance, but also that we help our customers be in compliance as well too. So a lot of the banks and admins are quite honestly still working through exactly what the regs and the processes are. You know, but in the meantime, you know, the employers at bare minimum, they really should do a couple things. You know, number one, realize that, hey, the sky is not falling, okay? There's going to be some work that they're going to have to do, and at minimum, they need to make sure that they're engaging their vendors and, you know, seeking some help from outside counsel, especially remember that this touches their retirement plans as well as their HSAs. So, again, there's multiple impacts or potential impacts to employers and plan sponsors here. But that ultimately that, you know, hey, we'll get through this, and we'll be able to comply. It's just a matter of what do we need to do and the steps that we need to make sure to, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's. And that's just a little bit of work and time that will happen undoubtedly through the rest of the summer and into the fall heading into, you know, 2017. Other than that, you know, they need to make sure that they're watching for delays and changes and quite honestly just having those conversations on a going forward basis and being mindful of, hey, things may change or may get impacted.
But then you will be, HSA Bank will be there in a service capacity to really help your clients with this knowledge and education and help them through this process too, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously our the spectrum of what we can help them with is limited to obviously the products that we're talking about. So, for instance, in HSAs here, and again, they're going to have to seek help on for instance, 401k, if they offer 401k or 403b or 457s or whatever it may be. But ultimately, absolutely, I mean, again, we're here as a resource to help our clients. You know, one of the things, too, if somebody would like to have a little bit more information on the front end of this issue, just to understand a little bit deeper about the background and overview and potential impact on employers and advisors and that, we actually have a white paper that was released, I believe, about a week ago. And the white paper, you know, does a pretty good job just trying to outline a little bit more in depth of what the regulations are and keeps, you know, again, raising the awareness. And people can get that white paper for free off of our website. There's two easy ways to find it. If they go to our website at hsabank.com, in the upper right-hand side, there's a search bar. And if they just type DOL in the search, it actually comes up with the press release and a link to the white papers in that press release. And it's the very first link. Or if they want to, they can just go directly to hsabank.com/DOL-fiduciary-standards, and that'll bring you right to where they can pick up the white paper for free and at least give them some information and background as well.
That's a great place to end, Kevin, a great place to leave our audience with that thought and where to download that white paper. It's been great having you on the program. We'll have to have you again real soon. I look forward to catching up with you personally in the near future, but thank you so much for today.
Absolutely. You guys have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
Take care.
Good stuff.
Yeah, great program today.
Yeah, it's a good program. Two very interesting emerging topics that, you know, kind of under the radar that people need to be aware of, you know. That,
yeah,
you know,
there's always
protection around, right, you know, these DOL standards.
There's always a lot to keep track of. So thank you to everyone listening today. Just a couple final notes, final reminders here. If you want to nominate for Superstars, last day is Monday. Just go to our website, theicc.com. You'll see a tab on the homepage. And then Tuesday is another deadline, and that is for Private Exchange Forum in Baltimore. That is the final day that you can get our early bird rates. Wednesday morning, prices will be going up. So if you're interested in joining us in Baltimore, where we'll talk all about the future of benefits tech, benefits delivery, healthcare consumerism, and private exchanges, be sure to register by the end of the day on Tuesday.
Thank you, everyone, for spending part of your Friday morning with us here on Healthcare Consumerism Radio. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Friday here on Healthcare Consumerism Radio.